Hello, welcome to our second panel in which we will explore the relationship between hegemonic memories, silence, and nationalism. Please allow me to welcome our first panelist. The first speaker is Barbara Tornquist-Pleva. Barbara is a professor of European Studies and the Dean of Research for the Joint Faculty of Humanities and Theology at Lund University, Sweden. She's a prominent scholar in the field of memory studies and a prolific author with 4 monographs and 25 edited volumes and counting. Her research focuses on difficult heritage and contested identities of in-between places, such as Central, Eastern, and North European borderlands. Presently, she's working on a research project entitled Lessons from Communist and Nazi History, a Genealogical Approach. Her presentation is entitled Changing Narratives About the Past of Wroclaw, Struggles Over Mnemonic Hegemony in a City. Please, Barbara, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Johanna, for this very nice presentation of me. And I jump directly to my 12 minutes. I will see if I manage it. Let me start to present you main objective of my presentations. It is to discuss and describe and analyze the dynamics between the hegemonic memories and counter memories, using the case of the local memory of the Polish city of Wrocław. And this is based on a study, or actually on two studies. One I did in 2014-2015 with my colleagues in Wrocław. And on the second study that I started just this year, which is a follow-up of the previous one, aimed to investigate how this dynamics is ongoing, how the local memories are influenced by this nationalist conservative turn on the national level of politics in Poland. So this is kind of stages in developing of hegemonic memories and counter narratives that I want to present. I would also like to touch upon a theoretical question, which I will not have time to elaborate on, but I think it's important to think about it in the context of my presentation, and it is about the relation between the hegemonic narratives of the past and its relation to official memory and popular memory. The question which is important is to ask when a narrative becomes hegemonic. Is it enough that it is dominating in official memory and promoted from above, or do you need as well to see the reflection in popular memory on the level of the Grecus, how they relate to this official narratives projected from above? So I think this is something which is important to discuss further. But why the case of Wrocław? Why is it so interesting? It is precisely because in context of this symposium, it's a good example of post-conflict city. Wrocław is situated on the territory that before the Second World War belonged to Germany and it was taken over by Poland after 1945 due to the Potsdam Agreement. And what happened was that the inhabitants of the city were expelled and replaced by Polish people coming from East and Central Poland, and Eastern territories taken from Poland by Soviet Union. So the German inhabitants that completely dominated Wrocław disappeared after the Second World War. And the Polish inhabitants had to deal with this legacy of the German past, which was very problematic to them because not least because of the Second World War. So what happens in the year following the war and was that the new rulers of Poland on central level and local level established a narrative about Wrocław as being ever Polish. So in a way, they was claimed that Wrocław belonged to Polish territory in the medieval times and later was lost for Germany, but now returned, so to say, to mothership, and it was the justice of history that it was returned to Poland. And in line of this narrative, there was an idea that the all remnants and traces of the German past, of the German cultural legacy, should be erased. What and it in principle, what actually it's actually happened. And what we see here is a kind of interesting. A kind of coincidence of two wheels. On the one side, it's a communist government that wants to have this erasure of the German past, but there is also, it fits very well with the needs of the, on the grassroots level, of the inhabitants of Wrocław. Thanks to different factors. One is that there is a very well established narrative template in the Polish culture about Germans as a kind of eternal others, eternal enemies, always wanting to control Polish people. And in the context of the war trauma after the Second World War, it was this template was even more strengthened. And there was also a need on the Polish migrants to the city to be rooted and make the city their home. Why they wanted and to make it over, so to say, to erase its alienness, its Germanness. And this last factor, which was important in the context, it was this feeling of insecurity among the inhabitants, that when we interviewed them, they always told us that for many years they were afraid that Germans will come back and take this territory again. So in this way, it was a very strong homogenic national narrative of this local history. However, it is interesting that we could trace that it started to be questioned by the generation born in Wrocław after the war. So to say, children to the migrants. And this process started very slowly in the 1970s and was strengthened in the 1980s, especially within the circles of the democratic anti-communist opposition that in Wrocław, local oppositional activists that questioned this narrative. And it was precisely these people belonging to this actively active people in opposition in the 90s that later took over the local government in Wrocław after the fall of communism in 1989. So since 1989, Wrocław is ruled by the liberal parties. It was even if they were, of course, several elections. It is always the liberals who won these elections and dominated and dominate until today the local government. And these people were very much decisive on the point that they want to change this nationalist narrative of Wrocław and worked to present Wrocław as a symbol of Polish-German reconciliation. So they worked to and acknowledge and recognize the German cultural legacy in the city. by rewriting local history, putting up new monuments, new exhibitions in the local museums, even coming back to some German names in the city. But this, of course, was not very much applauded by all, but there was quite a strong resistance against it. I would say it was a conflict between this dominant narrative coming from above, from the local rulers, and the counter-narrative on the grassroots level that could be summarized in the question put quite many times in the media, especially social media, when the people ask if it is about the German memory of the German Wrocław, or rather German, it means non-Polish memory of Wrocław that was projected here. So there was several conflicts. One especially interesting was about the changing of the name of this quite impressive building in Wrocław, so-called Jahrhunderthalle or Centennial Hall, as it was called in German times. And during communist time, it was rebaptized to People's Hall, and then local authorities in the 1990s came back to the old name as a gesture of recognition of the German cultural heritage. It was very much opposed. I don't have time to elaborate on this question, but this conflict was rather illustrative for this tension between the local narrative projected from above and the reactions on the grassroots level. So what happened after some decade of this this projecting of a new kind of memory narrative was that Wrocław authorities, local authorities, tuned down the Germanness of the city and instead started to promote new narrative about the Wrocław as multicultural city. That could be called a kind of myth, because Wrocław in 1945 was not multicultural, but very much dominated by Germans. But of course, if you dig down in the past, you can refer to times when Wrocław belonged to Poland, to Czech Crown, to Habsburg, and so on. And it was done in this new narrative, which was promoted also in order, as it was explained to us by representative of the local rulers, that it was done to change local identity. And Wrocław was branded as a city of encounters and very much inscribed in EU politics of memory, emphasizing the cultural diversity. An interesting example of this is the quarter of Podemination, an initiative done in cooperation between local authorities and grassroots initiative, making it a symbol of multiculturalism. Johanna, should I end now, or can I continue some minutes?
Unfortunately, I have to ask you maybe to finish up here. I'm sorry.
Yes. Okay. So let me say just that after 2015, after the turn in Poland, the nationalist conservative turn in Poland, in these local authorities has to meet a challenge of visibility of very strong, even far-right counter-narratives. I don't have time to elaborate on this, but it includes verbal attacks on the liberal measures of Wrocław, taking them to the courts because accusing them of betraying Polish national interests, selling the city to Germans, and so on and so on. So what I have seen now in my current investigation of the city that the local authorities start to change their strategy. They don't want to approach the past in such a very challenging and way as they did before, but instead they avoid the past and focus on defense of the image of Wrocław as open, tolerant and inclusive city by forming a new strategy. So the past is avoided, but still they try to use it as a springboard for keeping alive this created new identity of Wrocław. Okay, I think I have to thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Barbara. Sorry about it.
It's okay. It's time.
Craig's presentation is entitled Post-Memory in Post-Conflict Societies, Reflections from Lebanon. Craig, over to you.
Great. Hi, and thank you once again for your kind invitation. It's a pleasure to be part of this symposium. The themes are indeed central to my own research in the Middle East and also my own personal experience growing up in Belfast. The title of my talk, Post-Memory in Post-Conflict Societies, Reflections from Lebanon, I think is a little problematic, and that is the nature of post when we understand memory and post-conflict. As Baruka has argued, the prefix of post is indeed deceptive because it implies a clean break from the past, when in fact, what in actuality, the past continues to haunt the present through lingering legacies of violence, humiliation, and injustice. There's probably no more poignant a symbol of the legacy of the Lebanese Civil War than that of its new war museum, Beit Beirut. This is a 1920 style Ottoman building, the Barakat building, that was at the junction and at the heart of the Lebanese Civil War in Beirut. It divided the east and west along the Damascus Highway, and it also was a significant sniper point for the Lebanese forces. For years, it was a ruinous reminder of the destructive past, but pressure grew for the redevelopment, particularly through Solidaire of Beirut's downtown, and it was only the intervention of architects and civil activists saved this building and turned it into Lebanon's first war museum. So you can see here in the images, it still remains quite empty as a shell. It opened in 2017 and it hosts art exhibitions and seminars. In fact, one of the first was by Zaina El Khalil's Sacred Catastrophe, and she constructed 17,000 green poles in the second and third floors of this building as a representation of the disappeared in the Lebanese Civil War. But despite an official recruitment process, Beit Beirut still is no curator or even a permanent collection dealing with the war. It remains, I would argue, very much in limbo, a reminder of the past, but mostly an aesthetic backdrop for cultural and civil society events, unable to really provide critical historical examination. As Ella Parry-Davis and I argue, and she took these wonderful images, to install a permanent exhibition in Beit Beirut, that is to turn the building into a memorial site, into a museum, would be a radical step towards an official history of the Civil War. Now, this would be near impossible to agree on what that narrative should actually recount, but it would also implicate the state in acknowledging the violent past of the present political elite. Beit Beirut, I think, asks challenging questions of Lebanese society and what can actually be remembered and forgotten, particularly how can such a project be realized when there's recent instability and ongoing protests? Who in fact has the right to tell this history, and how do you incorporate conflicting and contested narratives? And what should the next generation of Lebanese, how do they actually view this building? And in my work, I've been interested in the next generation. I interviewed Lebanese students many years ago during this process of reconstruction, and their views were very varied. For some, it was a total rejection The building and the museum represents a Christian Lebanese forces symbol of death. For others, it's not the right timing. It's still too sensitive, as Ruba says, how many innocent people were shot from those windows. Another Lebanese young person, Pierre, said, maybe they should just keep the shell. The image is powerful enough. We don't need to know what actually happened inside. Some Lebanese youth are more skeptical. Rassan says, it's an exploitive attempt to cash in on Beirut's violent past. Probably we'll be running civil war tours soon, free militia t-shirts and baseball caps. Aya, 17, from Shia in Beirut, is much more reflective. She argues, it provokes us to remember and ask questions about the war, to think about what happened in these specific buildings and to decide it must never happen again. I think in these diverging youthful responses, we see some of the post-war narratives and debates on whether memory is needed to stop a repetition of the conflict, whether forgetting would actually provide a means of not returning to violence or a complete rejection. The Lebanese War, which occurred between 75 and 1990, killing around 150,000 people, displacing over two-thirds of the population, was led by a tie of peace in 1990 that included amnesty, but also public censorship of any discussion on an official level of the conflict. But instead, memory discourses have been promoted by activists, by scholars, and they're still very much prevalent in local oral traditions. My research has explored these multiple and polyvalent memories and their inscription and transformation, particularly in the lives of the next generation, a post-memory generation. And that's where I want to briefly look at the concept of post-memory. Post-memory is best defined as a residual type of memory, a recollection of an event not personally experienced, but socially felt. A traumatic rupture that indelibly scars a nation, a religious group, a community, or a family. Marianne Hirsch posits this concept in relation to the overwhelming weight of Holocaust memory and its discursive power, particularly through photographs and visual images, to shape Jewish historical consciousness. For Hirsch, post-memory exists as this powerful and particular form of memory because its connection is to an object. It's not mediated through recollection directly, but imaginative investment and creation. It helps provide mnemonic frames and schemata for affirming social identities, communal traditions, but also it can imprison people within historical discourses, she argues, that have silenced us verbally, that defy narrative reconstruction and exceed comprehension. In other words, post-memory suggests that traumatic historical events, whether distanced by time or distorted by political design, they cannot easily be buried or forgotten. And what I became interested in while post-memory research had focused on the Holocaust, its applicability to other post-conflict settings, settings of rupture, violence, genocide, displacement, and increasing work across looking at South America, Southeast Asia, Northern Ireland, the Balkans, have applied post-memory frames. And in a way, looking at intergenerational transmission of trauma, not just through photographs, as Hirsch highlights, but through visual sites, urban landscapes, the remnants of the past, how they affect. Hussein argues these are the memoryscapes that inform identity formation, the traumascapes that emotively connect us to past conflict. So how does post-memory work in a Lebanese context? A few years ago, I conducted over 100 interviews with Lebanese students for my book, Memory and Forgetting in Lebanon, but also more recently, 2009 surveys reveal again post-memory at work. These are just some of the narratives. As Alan argues, I was born in 1990 when it all ended, but I hear all the stories, I have pictures of the war, and I have memories of the buildings and what happened there. Sometimes when we drive through an area, I'm reminded of the past, the violence, the destruction, it still shouts out to you. Rami instead talks about the deaths, the events, much like the Troubles in Northern Ireland. The Lebanese Civil War is referred to as the events, and they remain a big void, a nebulous concept, You don't know what's inside. You know it's black. You know it's there. It's ominous, but you don't know what's inside. Georges, a 21-year-old Saint-Joseph University student, says, at times I want to close my eyes, ears, and cover my ears to my parents' stories of war. It was their conflict, not mine. I don't want to carry their burdens, yet these memories are difficult to escape. Yanni, they appear suddenly and sometimes in unexpected places. Post-memory in Lebanon is loud, foreboding, and at times inescapable. I just want to very briefly look at some of the most dominant narratives, post-memory narratives that are prevalent within Lebanese society. And of course, this is understanding post-memory as a dynamic, contextual phenomenon. Firstly, we see rejection, the idea that this was not our war, it was theirs. And this is common. Rassan Twaini wrote a book of the Lebanese war, and it was called The War of Others on Our Soil. This popularized the idea that the Lebanese conflict was mostly due to external intervention. It had limited Lebanese involvement. And I think this idea has been subverted by a generation who focus very much on the guilt and responsibility of the previous generation. Now, while some reject it, there is also a strange attraction and curiosity for this is seen in one cafe, 1975. This cafe was closed, but it became popular in a downtown part of Beirut. It was a cafe which you could come sit in underground bunkers. Walls were lined with remnants, graffiti, and you were curious. And asked the owner of this bar what exactly was going on. He said, the war is over, but many people need to think about what happened. With many different ages of people, some older who love the nostalgia, the music, the songs, some young people who don't even know anything about the war, but they're interested in experiencing something about it. So there's rejection, nostalgia, but I think also quite common is the narrative theme of recurrence, the idea that the war continues, an invisible, visible war. Even though the war ended in 1990, the same protagonists, those former militia leaders, have become politicians. There are recurring tensions in certain neighborhoods of Beirut, that the conflict and war is ongoing. Fourthly, there's the narrative of redemption, that in fact, many young people do not want to focus just on victimhood and suffering, but on personal resilience and bravery, how their family was able to move beyond the war. This has also turned into a narrative that has redirected the war. Instead of focusing on an internal conflict, it focuses on an existential struggle against Israel. This is very much seen in Hezbollah's new Museum of Resistance Tourism, a tourist jihadi center, as Nasrallah calls it, opened in May 2010, 10 years after Israel withdrew from Lebanon. It's a space where you can see Hezbollah weaponry and also Israeli tanks and confiscated material from former wars. It becomes a site of this both physical. It's built into a hill where there's resistance tunnels, but it's also spiritual or supernatural. The idea of sacrifice and the argument that Hezbollah have become the liberators and sanctifiers of South Lebanon. Again, this is quite a controversial argument. Finally, war memory is provoked in resistance and revolution. In fact, what we see, it is infused with contemporary struggles. It becomes an idiom for political change, and it takes new forms in popular uprisings, whether in 2006, the You Stink campaign of Thawra 2019. And You Stink is a protest over the recycling of ability to recycle garbage. And we can see here the Lebanese politicians and the argument that some trash should not be recycled. Thawra 2019, again, is a critical attack on the Lebanese sectarian system as part of the new post-war legacy. So what are the findings very quickly on Lebanese post-memory? And what I would argue my research suggests is the persistence of Civil War memory, resistant to official silence, and selective and subversive in the discourses that it creates. What we find is a disorientated and disillusioned and liminal generation that are trying to reconcile public censure and private anguish. They're trying to reconcile a history that is not really discussed in schools or publicly, but yet is on everyone's lips. This tension and to mass migration, depression, ongoing problems within society. What's evident is also that unresolved war memories can be easily mobilized during periods of flux and instability, reactivating grievances and contemporary tensions. We see this very much in communal hostility around identity politics over anniversary dates of the war, particular neighborhoods that were engaged in conflict. And just recently on the 7th of May, a Hezbollah takeover in 2008, we see it's over war memory now taking place on Twitter. Whether the 7th of May was a glorious day for many supporters of Hezbollah or a day of shame, particularly looked at by the Sunni community.
Thank you, Craig.
Finally, how does post-memory work in post-conflict settings? I just want to make a few brief points. And that is that we see the proliferation of post-memory studies, and it's also taking new interdisciplinary forms, trauma studies, psychological accounts. But post-memory can feed into polarized identities. It provides a repertoire for future confrontation and violence, and there can be transgenerational attachment to victimhood. Memorialization sites and practice allow for this effective and embodied connections to the past. But I just also say, while post-memory can be used to transfer conflict and hostilities, there is a possibility for greater interaction with transitional justice, a working through, as Hirsch herself argues, perhaps it is only in subsequent generations that trauma can be witnessed and worked through. So we'll need to look at post-memory and its interventions in education, truth processes, and perhaps also mediation. I'll just end there, thanks.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we almost don't have time for Q&As, but still let me throw one for maybe all of you and whoever wants to take it, take it. What is needed for a narrative or a memory to become hegemonic?
I may start because it was one of my questions when I worked with this paper, because in my view, the really hegemony, can we speak of, when we have this overlapping between, on the one side, official memory promoted by the ruling elites or intellectual elites, but if they also can take roots in a popular memory, in a way when they start to circulate and be internalized by people at large, then I think personally that we can speak about a real hegemony. And I saw it in my case in Wrocław for this post-war stage in the local memory of Wrocław. But then we have this time, post-communist time, when there is strong official memory promoted on the local level, and it silenced to some extent, even sometimes consciously tries to silence counter memories on the grassroots level. But the question is, as long as this new narrative did not really become internalized in the popular memory, can we speak about its real hegemony or not? I wonder.
Thank you. Thanks to all our panelists for your insightful contribution, and also many thanks to the members of the audience for the questions. I would like to strongly encourage you to stay online and to use the chat function to try to answer at least some of them. And now we will conclude our morning session and break for lunch and to let all the information sink in as well. We will, as I said, we will leave this room open for another approximately 20 minutes and enable the chat function so that you can chat with, you know, the panelists and the audience, and if you wish so. We will meet again at 1 p.m. London time, 1 p.m. British summer time. And to join us, that's very important, please use the afternoon session link, which we sent you as well, which we provided you by email. See you again in 1 hour. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye. Thank you. Our pleasure.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.